Drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple?
It's been 20 years since Australia joined the Coalition of the Willing, and the US President George W. Bush launched Operation Iraqi Freedom. It was a choice that drew mass protests around the country, and while the war itself was relatively brief, fighting within Iraq continued, and it was years before troops were permanently withdrawn. Donna Mulhern is a writer and activist. In 2003, she travelled to Iraq as a human shield in the hope that Western bodies would help limit the war. She's written about her experiences in two books, Ordinary Courage and The Sacking of Fallujah. And Donna's my guest. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
The decision to go to a war zone to be a human shield is a pretty remarkable choice. You wrote in your memoir that I have to be here, I have to see all this. Why did you feel personally responsible to get involved in that war?
Well, I guess one of the reasons was because my country was one of the cheerleaders of the war. So, you know, the US could not have gone ahead, I don't believe, with that invasion without the support of the UK and Australia to form the Coalition of the Willing. And I was one of those many Australians questioning this, saying, hang on a minute, we're about to go to war with a country of which we have no conflict with. It didn't feel right. It wasn't right. To this day, it's not right. And so I felt a very strong sense of responsibility because my country was about to go and bomb theirs, Iraq. And I felt I really needed to do something about that. And when I heard about the opportunity to join the Human Shield movement, it just felt like the exact right thing to do.
I remember that moment when the news broke. I was living in a small country town that was the major employer was a military base. And I just remember people's faces because they were all the partners that knew that this could one day pull in their service, you know, partner, be it a soldier or what have you. You arrived in Baghdad, I think, a month before the military conflict began. What were those days like? Did you think that the conflict would actually arrive?
No, we thought, how could they go ahead with this? Like, this is insane, because the weapons inspectors were still doing their job. They were still doing their inspections. We knew that the UN had questioned and deemed this to be improper and illegal. And so we were quite sure there was no way that they could go ahead with this. And so we were enjoying our time in Baghdad, getting to know the Iraqi people. And that was one of the biggest lessons of this entire experience to me. For me, one of the chapters in my book is called The Baghdad You Never Heard About. So all we'd heard about regarding Iraq, well, from my point of view anyway, was Saddam Hussein and wars and violence. It was like this one-dimensional country. I thought it was Islamic fundamentalist. I don't know why. I just had this image. When I got there, it was basically the opposite of what I'd imagined. So a very secular society, highly intellectual and artistic and thriving and funny and alive. And, you know, poetry readings by the River Tigris, you know, the orchestra, the symphony on Friday nights at the National Theatre, big sculptures throughout the centre of Baghdad depicting tales of the 1001 Nights, a highly cultured people. Very highly educated. They were speaking to us in English. We could barely speak any Arabic. And they wanted to talk about the latest novel or poet that you'd read. And I had no idea that such sophistication, such a sophisticated and cosmopolitan country. And I remember was that I wish John Howard could come here and meet these people and Alexander Downer. We had a lot more in common than not. And it saddened me every time when Iraqi people would say to me, you're Australian? Wow, we love Australia. We love Australia. You're really good at sport. You're really funny. We love your movies. They've watched Crocodile Dundee. It was hilarious. And then their face changed and they said, why are you coming here with your bombs and guns? Why is your army? Why are you sending your army to Iraq? We thought you were our friends. That was always a very difficult conversation and one that I had a reasonable answer for.
Of course, you'd been a journalist and a ministerial advisor. Were you at all surprised that our allies more or less involved us in this war, given what you knew about the halls of power?
Well, I knew that they had ambitions, they being in the US. You know, there was, I think, planning or hopes to get a hold of more real estate in the Middle East for a very long time. But whether they had, you know, such brashness to really go ahead, I didn't probably believe it until the night of the 20th of March, lying in a bed, a steel bed in the water treatment plant in Baghdad, and I heard the first missiles coming. And someone in the next bed said, "It's begun. It's begun." It was only at that moment that we really believed that that they would really go ahead with it, knowing the consequences and that this was illegal.
You remained in Baghdad for about 10 days before leaving the country. What were those early days of the war like after that night where it began?
It was awful. It's hard to describe the sound of missiles raining down, but the noise is so loud it feels like your eardrums will explode and bleed. The noise is unbelievable, and the shaking of the room all the time, the lack of sleep, not being able to sleep through the night just because of the noise and the missile attacks. But the worst part was then venturing out to see what the wreckage and the damage was from the night before. And we were determined to bear witness. I was particularly, and with a journalistic background, I was taking notes of everything and documenting everything. And I felt it was an important role for me to bear witness and then and speak about it and report on it. So we went to the hospitals. We went to the places where there were bombings to verify, well, this is a civilian site, clearly. This is the Al-Shawala marketplace. As I walked through the Al-Shawala marketplace, all I could see was mashed up pieces of fruit, mashed in with pieces of human flesh, puddles of blood. It was a civilian site. There was no military installations anywhere nearby. They said it was a mistake. But it was a mistake with a very high cost, a very high civilian cost. So it was a nightmare to both experience the feeling of thinking I was going to die every night. I didn't know if I was going to make it through the night, wake up the next day and just be thankful that I'm alive another day, but then to realise that you're sharing this experience with 5 million other people in Baghdad and 20 million throughout the country of Iraq, and that I could leave, but they couldn't. It was really tough.
If you just joined me on RN Drive, I'm joined by Donna Mulhern. We're looking back on the 20th anniversary of the war in Iraq. Donna is a human rights activist and writer and was a human shield during the Iraq war. I'm just curious, Donna, if you'd had any other acts of conscience like that before. As a journalist, you tried to stay impartial or somehow separate, but had you felt like this on other stories that you'd been involved in? Had you involved yourself personally in those causes and issues that you'd reported on?
I guess only probably to the degree of a point of view of charity, of raising funds for other places where there'd been war and violence and doing some advocacy, etc. But by the time February, March 2003 came around, I'd left my job in politics and I was freelancing, so I felt I had more independence and power to act upon my conscience. And my conscience was telling me that I needed to do something. My country was involved in this. And around at that time, I'd been studying nonviolence and the power of nonviolence in the tradition of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, etc. And I was learning that war is not inevitable. It's a extraordinary diversion from the progress of humanity and civilization. Extraordinary. And it generally fails as well. So in 78% of cases, war fails to achieve the goals of which it's set out to do. So I also knew that.
Well, the goals change, as we know.
And in this case, that's exactly what happened. The goals changed because it was convenient to have those goals changed when no weapons of mass destruction were found. And so I guess I'd found myself in a position where I was human being first. Journalist second.
That's really interesting, yeah. And a kind of an alignment of a different, chances really. If you weren't free to chase that, none of this story would have been told. Of course, the impact of the war isn't just felt in the initial moment of impact. Tell me about your trip back to Fallujah in 2012.
Well, so that was many years on from the initial invasion, and I wanted to go to Iraq then and have the feeling and to see that it was better. that things had improved and that was it was kind of okay now. That did not happen. It was by far in worse condition than the previous time I'd been there in 2004. So what I saw, for example, in the city of Fallujah was a city that had in no way recovered from its attacks in 2004. It was being systematically discriminated against and oppressed by the government at the time. And it had a medical emergency related to birth defects. We have a situation in Fallujah today where if you're a woman of childbearing age, it's likely you will not give birth to a healthy child. So the doctors in Fallujah, their advice to women is just don't try because it's very unlikely you'll give birth to a healthy child. So I went to Fallujah Hospital and, walked around the maternity wards and saw the babies being born with their stomachs out or with strange lumps on their heads or with congenital heart defects. Most of them didn't live more than 3 days, the ones I met. So this is a human catastrophe for this city and barely known outside of Iraq, barely reported on. And so I took it upon myself to try to tell that story and to give voice to those women and to tell those stories and try to raise awareness about that issue of the use, such an intense use of not just conventional weapons, but speculated weapons containing depleted uranium and also white phosphorus. When that happens in a small neighbourhood to such an extent over a period of days and weeks and months, something happens, like it's toxic. It's the toxic remnants of war that has created this medical catastrophe in Fallujah. You can put that across a lot of Iraq, though. Down in the south, there's also areas that are quite toxic because of the use of depleted uranium, both in the first Gulf War as well as the war in 2003. So Iraq is it's today a failed state, still struggling to function. A lot of political instability and many would say oppression and little freedom and human rights, which is ironic.
I hesitate to ask you this because I fear I know the answer, but what lessons do you think were learnt from the war in Iraq and what lessons weren't learnt?
Well, I'll start with weren't. Because it's just so front of mind at the moment, especially in Australia. So lessons that were not learned, I believe, relate to the actual decision to commit a country to war. So in Australia, and many people don't realise this, the federal parliament is not required to vote before Australia enters into a war, which is extraordinary because it's the gravest decision a country will ever make. It's the prime minister and or the executive that can make that decision. And that system has not done well for us. So three words to give evidence for that, and that is Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. Okay, so things may have turned out different had there been debate and discussion before entering those three arenas of war with Australian troops. So I think the lesson from Iraq 20 years on is that surely we need a better system, a system that's more transparent, accountable and democratic, and that is that we have a modest legislative change so that if there's pending war and talk of Australian involvement, that there be a debate on the parliamentary floor, House of Representatives and the Senate, with our representatives bringing our voice to the chamber and scrutinising such a decision. So there's actually been a parliamentary inquiry called to examine this exact question. It's currently in process. There were over 100 submissions, the majority of which were in favour of reform to change our system. And this is just bringing us up to date with other liberal democracies. It's not radical. It's not a radical change at all. It's easy to do. It's workable. And yet the noises coming out of government are not looking promising for change. And then we had, with the AUKUS decision now, it's almost impossible for Australia to independently step back from a war that our allies might want to participate in. This is a very grave state of affairs. And so lesson not learnt 20 years on, the lesson, it's like, let's get the band back together. America, Australia, and England back together. Like, it didn't work out well the first time. The performance was not good. So I don't know, why didn't we learn that lesson?
Yeah, this 20th anniversary really falls in a week where national security is in the news, and whether or not Australia's complicit in the decisions of our allies again is the question. Donna, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being my guest.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.